Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican's podcast. I'm Chris Gunness. This is The Art of Change, a series featuring artists who are passionate about changing the world. Today, the third in a four-part series featuring Stephen Fry, writer, actor, comedian, and campaigner. Last time, Stephen talked with moving honesty about his own suicide attempts as he battled manic depression. Next, I explored his advocacy for such things as gay rights, prostate cancer, and delegitimizing mental health. I put it to him that far from choosing his issues, they had chosen him.
Well, I've got to be honest and say it is personal. In that sense, it's egotistical. I'd be far more admirable if I was advocating for causes to which I had much less connection, if you like. And I suppose, though, it's an example of a kind of charity begins at home attitude. I remember joking to my urologist when I was had this prostate.
I want to hear all about that too, by the way.
Yeah, and one of the things they sometimes do in order to stop it's rather bizarre, to stop these cancer cells from spreading, metastasizing, as they like to call it, they give you an androgen suppressant that suppresses your testosterone and therefore apparently suppresses these cells from replicating and spreading. And one of the, obviously you make jokes. So I said to her, I've noticed I'm so sensitive, I'm so much less shallow, and I'm so much, I'm able to also have three different conversations at the same time. I'm maybe turning into a woman, But I said, and of course, what happens now that if I get this gynecomastia, as they call it, where you start to grow breasts, I said, it means I'll have to start talking about breast cancer charities as well. And it was a sort of mocking myself for the fact that the only charities I seem to support are ones where I have some connection. And I suppose it's partly because I'm deeply aware, and a lot of us are, of how it falls on the ear when a privileged actor starts lecturing people about what they should support and what's right and what's wrong. So if I can speak from experience rather than apparently just giving a lecture on this is the way the world should be, but actually say I know what it's like to be like this is that, then it comes over better. So even with things like a charity I support is Reprieve, which is an extraordinary work it does. Clive Stafford Clark founded it. Saves people off death row and people have been in prison for Guantanamo and other places in Turkey and in Iraq and Iran, and all kinds of places supporting people there. Well, I did go to prison as part of my troubled adolescence. So again, at least I can feel that that's something where I know whereof I speak a little. And obviously, being born gay, growing up in a period when gay liberation was beginning to happen and then was set back enormously by the terror of the AIDS epidemic and so on, I felt able to be in a lucky position in a profession where coming out as gay is no news at all.
But it could have been damaging. I mean, you chose to speak out on these issues.
Yes. There were very few others. I mean, even Ian McKellen hadn't come out when I came out.
Wow.
not that I'm claiming I'm braver than Ian, because, he's done so much good in this field. But, I suppose so. But I kind of knew I was never going to get offered the parts that Brad Pitt had turned down, so it was not like we can't cast him because he's gay.
But you could have been discriminated against.
I could have been, I suppose, and yes, and I just on a occasion had, you know, faggot and queer shouted at me in football matches or whatever, but it's very rare. And it's now was dealt with very strongly, especially at football matches. You know, if anyone was to do that, they'd be banned for life. And, you know, I'm glad to say, because that kind of thing is just so harmful. It's not harmful for me because I'm big enough and ugly enough to take it, but it's the kids in the playground. You know, they still have to face bullying and torment and mockery of the worst possible kind, and it takes immense guts on the part of kids, because haven't we heard this since we were young? They grow up so fast, but because pornography and sexual information and sexual availability is of a different order now from what it was. I mean, you know, I used to get thrilled at the idea if I could buy a copy of Health and Efficiency magazine as a naturism magazine for nudists, you know, because I would actually be able to see a few
naked men
or National Geographic. Exactly, you know, I mean, this was the only possible opportunity. There was nothing like Pornhub and this and the, you know. And so it's a very different world, and who knows? Who knows what it's doing? But it does put pressure on the young, and I think anything that can. Because really, Chris, one of the things is to, it's an old quote of G.K. Chesterton's that I come up with from time to time, but angels can fly because they take themselves lightly. if you can show that for all the terrors and the things that you fess up to that have happened in your life, the agonies of your adolescence and of love and of the pain of your mental illness and so on, but that the way you show that you're living with it and coping with anything that fate throws at you is to try and take it lightly, to try not to turn inwards. And because I do think self-pity is awful, not just because it's ugly, which it is, it's not pleasant to witness it being exhibited, but because it's so damaging to the person who feels sorry for themselves. I mean, you know, if you would visit someone whom you knew was terminally ill and they were going, it's all right, a bit of pain here, you know, and you think, wow, God, you know. But when you know someone who's got a slight, you know, problem somewhere in an elbow and goes, you've no idea what I suffer. You think, oh, sod off. You know, I mean, it's just human nature, you know. Yeah. So it does you good with other people not to be sorry for yourself, because people are more like to help you. But also it does good to yourself to believe that you're not at the end of things, even if you feel you are for that moment, things can improve.
Stephen, I want to ask you about the international aspects of your advocacy on, for example, LGBT issues. You chose to go and confront homophobes in Brazil, in Russia, in sub-Saharan Africa. Where did this international thing come from?
Well, I think it so happens that I have a lot of admirers in both Russia particularly and in Brazil. In fact, when I had a bit of a mental breakdown in the mid-90s, a very wonderful a big pop star in Brazil called Zeca Baleiro wrote a song called Stephen Fry, in which he was sort of sending love and sympathy for me. Which
What are the words out of interest?
Dari Stephen Fry. They mean sort of, please come home, Stephen Fry, because I've gone missing. You know, please come home, we love you, Stephen Fry. It was terribly sweet.
Yes.
And so touching. I think it's on Spotify.
Is that why you wanted to go to Brazil for...
Well, because he was an example of the fact that I did seem to have a fan base there through Jeeves and Worcester and other comedy things and so on. And similarly in Russia, I mean, my books sell extremely well in Russia, in Russian. So
why is that?
I don't know. It's very interesting. I think it started with Jeeves and Worcester. Russians always loved P.G. Woodhouse. They love this view of England. They find it funny. Maybe in the communist era, it was such an opposite to anything they had.
Yeah.
And because it was comic and light and didn't suggest that the life that Bertie and Jeeves and Lord Emsworth and others lived, but was comical, it wasn't suppressed by the regime. And so they read it and just found it sunny, which it is. He's the definition of good nature, P.G. Woodhouse. Anyway, so that was part of it. So I knew from letters that I got from Russia and from Brazil that things were turning towards this new kind of populism, that it was a bellwether of what was to come in populism. And there is something quite uniquely toxic when nationalism, almost fascistic nationalism, and religion come together. Mm. And this was happening in Russia with the Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox figures who were beginning to get power in Putin's new Russia, and with this new sense of nationalism within that regime as well. And the same, and so I interviewed this senator, Bolsonaro, in Brazil, who is now
later to become
the president. I had no idea, and he was a frightening example of this militarism and religion, sentimentalized religion, fantasy of militarism, which we've all seen in fascism. And it's, of course, it does no service to anyone to compare everyone endlessly to Hitler and Nazism, but all forms of fascism, whether Franco and Mussolini, had this mixture of a kind of weird sentimental fantasy view of the military. It's just a kind of masturbatory fantasy mixed with a religious. I mean, it's, the whole thing is a weird iconography of religion and jackboots and when that happens, you know, the bones are broken on the pavement, and the first you choose are the other, whether it's Jews or gay people, and so I thought, you know. Just at the time everything's getting so good in Britain, we're getting equality, and I wasn't married yet, it wasn't quite the equal marriage, but, you know, things had really got better and better for gay people like me in Britain. I was getting all these letters saying, you know, not saying churlishly, it's all right for you, but saying, you know, we've got this. And I thought, well, it just seemed the right thing to try and do couldn't be complete, but a sort of view around the world, so India and the United States, gay therapy in some United States and Brazil and Uganda, where a lot of Pentecostalists were financing some of the most homophobic legislation, which they tried for death sentences for gay people in Uganda. And I love Uganda. I've been there before for Comic Relief, and that was one of the countries I most instantly warmed to.
There's that wonderful confrontation with the minister who ends up saying, I'll lock you up! And Stephen, I mean, this sort of touched on something which I find so impressive, particularly about your confronting homophobia. You will not be bought over in any way by any of these arguments. You have this profound conviction in your own values, and no one can take that away from you. Where does all that stuff come from?
I'm not sure. I mean, again, it seems pretentious, but I mentioned it before because of his description of Beethoven's Fifth, but Ian Forster was a huge influence on me. When I first read The Longest Journey and then Howard's End, it was like an explosion in my head amongst many other writers and things. And in the torment of this adolescence, I described the Sturm und Drang, as Germans like to say, the storm and stress of it, I got this idea that the secret to life could be found in books and art. And growing up in a pretty remote part of the Norfolk countryside, with as Sidney Smith once said, simply miles from the nearest lemon. it was books it was books and poetry and music that kind of made me feel alive. And the idea of Forster and his generation, much derided, of the sacred nature of human relations. And I felt that was the absolute truth, the touchstone. And it was there in Bertrand Russell and in Forster and G.E. Moore and that generation of Bloomsbury and others, and so it set my heart on going to university at Cambridge, which is where he had lived most of his life in the end, Forster, and where his friends and his fellow writers and artists and thinkers were. And I just loved this idea, and it did give me amongst other things this. That rooted belief, and part of that belief is that lots else is up for grabs, and that I'm not certain about all kinds of things. And the uncertainty principle is not just for physics. Bertrand Russell repeated it. I mean, he was absolute in logic and in what he did know, or at least what he could prove. But he was also absolutely certain that uncertainty was the right approach to things. So, yes, to be told that I'm evil is just nonsense. It's an assertion and kind of trained enough in the mind to know that an assertion is of no more value than another. You know, you have to show an example and to prove, I don't mean mathematically exactly, but to demonstrate by the example of a life or the example of a metaphor of a poem, if it can be, or that something you suggest is true is true. Otherwise, your experience says, well, no, it isn't true. Mm. I mean, you're merely asserting that something is wrong, and I've seen that it isn't wrong. But I can certainly not be comfortable with some of the almost bullying, hectoring, sanctimonious piety of our age. Mm. I don't like it. Partly because I've never liked sanctimonious piety, but also because I don't think it works.
In what sense?
Well, I think those who are very anxious to find more equality in the world, in gender, and to push for diversity and all the really important things that one can agree are natural human values and are to do with a justice and an equity that most people should be able to subscribe to, that they don't understand how sometimes a hectoring tone can just push people who should be persuaded by argument and reason and kindness and love and, you know, brotherly, you know, connection, who should be welcomed into this idea of how equality is good for all of us, instead of being pushed into making, oh, so I'm just privileged, am I? Mm. Oh, I grew up in the East End. Why are you calling me white privilege? You know, he said, well, it's just bad tactics. Mm. Don't call it white privilege, call it white advantage. And then people might understand it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. Because privilege is a word that has connotations. And it's as if people are tone deaf to the meaning of language. And so they alienate. And they give power to the Trumps of this world to be able to laugh at political correctness and wokeness, ho, 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 because there's so much self-righteous indignation where there should be warmth and humour about it and welcoming people into a world of equality and diversity and so on and showing them the advantages of it.
That was Stephen Fry ending this episode of The Art of Change on Nothing Concrete with me, Chris Gunness. Next time, the last in our four-part series with Stephen Fry, in which he'll talk about how comedy can change the world. You can subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review to help get the word out. Until next time, from me, Chris Gunness, goodbye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.